I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the World Cricket Show, the world's favourite cricket show. My name is Adam Bayfield and I'll be your host tonight. And with me as always is Tony Kerr.
Hey.
How's it going, Tone?
Good, thanks.
We're broadcasting from a new location tonight.
Add it to the Wikipedia article.
We have to move location after each recording.
Well, on the run.
Keep it top secret. Well, Yeah, chased by so many fans. You know, it's like a Trump rally. I don't want to talk about Trump. Trump rally.
It's out of date now, mate.
Yeah. But, you know, we just have to keep on the move. Always on the move. So perhaps we shouldn't say where we are.
Burner phones, just the lot. Secret drops. You drop the agenda off on a bench and I sort of walk along later and pick it up.
You're at my house, which this was certainly the first time we recorded in this house.
Yeah, we did. We had a spell at your old gaff.
Yeah.
And it was very cozy. It was extraordinarily cozy. And it would get very warm in there. This is like spacious.
Roomy, isn't it? This is our spare room, and it's kind of like an office/gym room at the moment.
There's activities.
There's not much in here other than a cross trainer, which neither of us use.
Kettlebells, is that you?
Nope. That's not me. Look around. Any gym equipment you see, not mine. The Starburst over here, that is mine.
The podcast equipment and Starburst, that's you.
But yeah, all the kind of fitness gear, nothing to do with me. there is a, behind you, Tane, there's a little aromatherapy
station.
Is that you? That is mine, yeah. Which actually, it was a Christmas gift from my wife. So I've got some essential oils.
What's she trying to say?
Going around the room here. It's all right, isn't it? Yeah, we've had, it's a bit makeshift. We've had to kind of pin the microphone arms on some chairs, and it feels a bit like it doesn't feel much like a podcast studio, I would say.
You can say that.
We'll make do. My one concern is that the street is just outside here, and we're kind of at the bottom of the hill, and there's a junction just the other side of the house. So people like come across the junction and then absolutely gun it going past, and we're just a few feet away. I mean, it's a little later in the evening now. It's not rush hour, you know.
Yeah, I'm not usually coming past till about 11, so it's fine.
But we might be interrupted by some motorbikes. Noisy motorbikes are the absolute bane of my life. I'm so angry about it. The older I get, the more time that goes by, the more angry I am about noisy motorbikes. I just don't know what it's going to be like in 10, 20 years' time, because I'm already boiling with anger.
I'm worried for the letters page of the local paper. No, I'm completely with you on it. You'll know when a motorbike's come past, because me and Adam will both be up, shaking our fists and shouting, bloody kids.
Banging on the window.
Yeah.
It's fine. I'd be fine about it, but I think we should have a new rule. This would be my in my manifesto if I were ever to run for local office. The new rule should be, you have as noisy motorbike as you like, but if you wake up my son, you have to get him back to sleep.
Yeah.
And actually, that goes for you too tonight, Tane. So try not to, you know, laugh too hard at any of my gags or anything like that. Because Teddy is asleep in the next room. So we'll have to bear that in mind. But anyway, let's get on with it, Tane. We're not going to tit around too much today because we've got a staggering amount of cricket to discuss, including arguably some of the best test cricket there has ever been. In the last week, I'm talking, of course, about Sri Lanka v England in Goole, and the Australia-India series was decent too. So, yeah, there's lots to get our teeth into. Let's start there. Let's start in Australia, because we are, of course, all still catching our breath after the completion of, as I say, one of the most remarkable test matches of all time in Brisbane. To round off one of the most remarkable test series of all time. We haven't done a pod since before the start of this series, so...
Didn't fancy it.
I've got a lot of ball-by-ball roundups to get through, but no, I'm sure, you know, most listeners have been well across this series, but just so we're on the same page, India, of course, after losing the first test in Adelaide, where they were bowled out for 36, the lowest test score since the 1950s, stormed back to win the Boxing Day test in Melbourne thanks to an extraordinary performance from standing captain Ajinkya Rahane, before holding out for a battling draw in Sydney thanks to a fifth day rearguard from Rishabh Pant and Ravi Chandran Ashwin, and then completing a stunning series victory with a record-breaking run chase in Brisbane. Australia batting first made 369 with Manas Labuschagne making 100, but India in response were really struggling at 186 for 6, and it seemed like Australia were on their way to a series winning victory, but then an astonishing partnership between Washington Sundar, the unheralded Washington Sundar and Shardul Thakur, got India up to 336, so only 33 behind. Australia did then race to 294 to set a pretty steep target, but Mohammad Siraj with 5 wickets kept India in the game, but they had a very tough ask in the fourth innings. They had to chase 328. I don't think any side had ever chased more than, was it 230-odd, I think was the record at Brisbane before that. So it seemed, going into the final day, it seemed like the most likely outcome was probably an Australia win. The second most likely outcome was the draw, and maybe even a distant third was an India victory. But Shubman Gill with 91, Chiteshwar Pujara with 56 from 211 balls, hung in there and kept India in it. And then Rishabh Pant came in and made 89 to, quite astonishingly, guide India to the target with 3 wickets and, what, about 3 overs to spare? I mean, it was just a staggering end to a staggering series, really, Tane. You, I think, watched the finale live. You said you woke up in the night.
I think there must have been something in the air because, yeah, I sort of woke up, I don't know, about 4-ish UK time. And obviously, yeah, aware of the match situation before I went to bed, but not, yeah, thinking like, oh, well, I'll check it when I get up at, you know, when I stir at about 5:30 or whatever it is.
9:15. Yeah,
I was sort of bolt awake, fast awake at 4 o'clock. Sort of, yeah, kept my eyes open for a little bit, then checked the phone. I was like, nah, sod it, I'm going to get up and watch it. And yeah, glad I did.
Yeah,
you were snoring away,
yeah,
at that point.
I was fast asleep. No, I did see the very end. But yeah, you must have watched the last couple of hours.
Yeah, I watched the last session and a bit before. It was, yeah, I mean, it's as good an end to a test match as you'll see. We'll come on to comparisons with other series and matches, probably pointless comparisons, really, because, yeah, just the whole thing was pretty phenomenal. Mm. And yeah, I think the series as a whole, but particularly the denouement, as you like to say, is it's as good an endorsement for Test cricket as there's probably ever been.
Yeah, it will certainly live long in the memory, won't it? And that footage will be trotted out. I mean, just to kind of go against what I said in the aftermath of the Headingley Test in 2019, where we talked about, you know, was that better than 81? Was it better than 2005? Was it, you know, where does it rank? And we kind of talked about that, and I sort of felt like it. I said at the time that I felt like that it is a bit pointless, where it's like, what, why do we have to reach for those comparisons immediately?
But
was it one of the best test matches or test series of all time? I mean, is that hyperbole, do you think, Tane, or do you think it is warranted? Was it, I mean, you've said it's as good an advert of test cricket, yeah, as you'll ever see. We can talk about the series as a whole maybe in a bit, but was it as good a test match?
I think so. I mean,
finale.
The comparison with Headingley is obvious, isn't it? But partly because obviously Headingley was so fairly recent. I mean, I don't think it's hard to be neutral about it, because obviously as an England fan, you know, I felt things in that, yeah, the end of that Headingley test that I wasn't feeling at the end of this. Although I was, you know, a sleepy me was out of the sofa a couple of times at sort of 5:30 in the morning. Because in some ways, in the end, it was actually India got there with a little bit to spare, which is kind of ludicrous when you think of like the achievement. Whereas at Headingley, there was probably slightly more jeopardy about the actual last, say, hour or the last kind of, you know, the last 60 or 70 runs. So in that sense, as a sort of pure finale to a test match, I think Headingley probably edges it. But in the context, this being in the context of kind of what had come earlier in the day with Pujara and the context of the series, this is probably a better narrative, kind of the overall picture. The fact that it was, you know, this test match, the series was decided, you know, in the last hour of the last day of the last match, whereas obviously Headingley came in slightly, you know, obviously it was a critical moment for England in the series, but there was still quite a lot to play. I mean, you couldn't have written this script. And it was at the Gabba, and obviously the backdrop of, you know, we'll go into the detail, won't we? But, you know, the backdrop of how many players India were without, who would have, you know, necessarily been in their first team without Kohli, who we knew about before the series, but for tests 2, 3, and 4, but without a whole host of other players who'd taken a battering or got injured or whatever, bookending that with 36 all out. I mean, yeah, I don't know. It's as astonishing an end result probably as you could imagine it in cricket, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a really good summary. I mean, you know that I am very allergic to recency bias, and that's kind of what I felt about Headingley, but you know, it happens a lot that people say that must be the greatest catch of all time, you know, and it almost always isn't. It's just that it's the thing you've just seen. But I do think that this has to be right up there for all those reasons that you've outlined. It's the narrative, the whole series, that meant it had all this context going into the final day. And then it goes down to not quite the wire, as you say. In the end, India did have 3 wickets to spare and a few overs to spare. So when they hit the winning runs, it had actually become inevitable at that point. But that does seem like nitpicking, maybe. But
that doesn't take much away from it.
But for it to go the distance like that, to go right down to the last few overs after the series that have been played, it's just, like, you really can't ask for much more. And the actual cricket on the final day was really high quality, really absorbing, really exciting. I mean, that, as you've alluded to, that Cummins-Pujara battle was just captivating stuff. I mean, Pujara got hit, 7 or 8 times on the body and the head. And, you know, and Cummins was bowling seriously quick and seriously hostile stuff. And Pujara, that was his slowest test 50, wasn't it? And this is a man who scores slow test 50s. It was incredible. And it must be, as you say, one of the best, in terms of the series, it must be one of the best performances by any team in test history, I think, even factoring in recency bias, because it's certainly one of the most unlikely victories, I think. I mean, all right, India were number one in the world not long ago. Australia had just displaced them, but, you know, that a lot of people would still probably have said that India were the best team in the world coming into this series. I think you could have made a good case for that. And 2 years ago, they came to Australia and won. So it's not like Bangladesh coming to Australia and winning, but it's completely different circumstances now to what it was 2 years ago when Australia didn't have Smith and Warner. They weren't the team that they are now. And so, and we talked about the series before it started, and I didn't really give them too much of a prayer, to be honest, because, you know, Kohli, we knew that Kohli would be missing after the first test, Smith and Warner back, India just maybe not quite at the same level that they were 2 years ago. And so I did think Australia would win fairly comfortably. And so maybe people might be thinking that, you know, it's time for a bit of humble pie. I know, you know, the likes of Michael Vaughan have been under fire from Indian fans particularly. And he has, to be fair to him, sort of put something out saying, yeah, I've got egg on my face and own up to it. But I don't necessarily think that he does have egg on his face, or like that humble pie is required, because actually that is what makes it extraordinary.
Yeah.
That it was so unlike. We weren't, in a sense, we weren't, I mean, I suppose by definition, we were wrong to think that they didn't have a chance because they've won it, but we weren't wrong in the assessment at the time. And that's what is so remarkable. And actually it's even more remarkable because, as you say, they faced all this adversity through the series in terms of the injuries and the unavailability. They didn't have Kohli, that was known beforehand, but, you know, they lost Mohammad Shami to injury. The list goes on.
They were
on.
Dropping like flies.
They lost Ashwin and Bumrah for this final test. I mean, yeah, the bowling attack for the final test, Siraj, Natarajan, Washington Sundar, Shardul Thakur and Navdeep Saini bowled a few overs as well. I mean, none of whom started the series, did they? So hard to put into words, really, just how incredible an achievement it is. Because also, you know, it's winning in Australia. I mean, Australia very, very seldom lose at home. They've lost a couple of times to South Africa. They've lost once to England and they've lost to India 2 years ago. And that's it in our lifetime. And they never lose at the Gabba. Yeah. They hadn't lost at the Gabba since 1988. And that was against possibly the best team of all time in West Indies with Viv Richards and Malcolm Marshall and Gordon Greenidge, etc. And since 2003, they've drawn twice and won the rest in, 17, 18 tests. So to win in Australia at all is remarkable. To come from behind to win in Australia is even more remarkable.
To come from being bowled out for 36.
To come from behind to win in Australia after getting blown away for 36 in the first test without your best player, with half your squad injured, is even more remarkable. And to do all that and seal the deal by winning at the Gabba is just kind of science fiction, isn't
it?
Yeah,
at the death. Fantasy, yeah. Ludicrous. Clearly, India are the cricket superpower, and so I find myself naturally, you know, as a someone who's inclined to cheer for the underdog. Not that Australia are the underdog in this, but you know, I'm slightly.
I know what you mean.
Sometimes, you're just kind of naturally resistant to kind of blowing smoke up the kind of, as I say, the cricket superpower. But but in this, watching this final day, I just enjoyed it so much and enjoyed the performances of Pujara and Pant so much. You know, it was just brilliant to watch. You know, just so much admiration for the way they played their roles. And obviously, the bit part from Washington Sundar as well was very well timed. The way Rahane kind of composed himself, handled himself, from that brilliant century earlier in the series to kind of pick up the mantle from Kohli and finish the job like this. I don't know, there was just so much joy. Shubman Gill as well, obviously another youngster who just played brilliantly. I've got a new love for Indian cricket for sure.
Well, I know what you mean, that it has been hard to get excited about a kind of underdog story when you're talking about India, because for reasons that we might come on to, they are, as you say, the superpower. And that doesn't mean that you're going to root for Australia as being the underdog either. But the kind of narrative that it's like a great sort of unlikely triumph doesn't quite wash. But then because of the fact they'd had all these injuries and the team was suddenly made up of all these young and inexperienced, new, fresh faces, suddenly it did feel more like an underdog story. And that did make it, easier as a neutral, I think, to get into it and get excited about it. This doesn't do much for your names theory of Test cricket, does it, Tone?
I don't know. I think there's
not
some
many
big
names in that
there.
Team.
Well, I'm not sure.
There's some who are going to be names for sure.
Yeah.
Becoming names already.
I mean, what was, it was just, I don't know. It kind of felt like it feels like a real moment for Test cricket, doesn't it? In that you had the absolute kind of archetypal, or to the extreme, resilience and batter me down before I give my wicket away from Pujara, combined with at the end that kind of this kind of modern approach to we need 145 what was it off the last session, and then as it got down to whatever it was 60, 70 a run a ball, there was no sense that they were going to kind of have a feel into it and see would they get there or not. They just put the foot down Pant and Sundar. Obviously it was just a little cameo from Sundar, but it was pretty brisk. And the moment that they put the foot down was so exhilarating, really. Some of the stroke play and the little ramps and the sweeps from across the wicket and stuff. It showed the future to me of Test cricket, really. It's got a future in that, you had this kind of the classical and the modern kind of fused together into such brilliant effect and taken at kind of extremes.
So, for all those reasons, I don't think it's hyperbole to suggest that this is one of the best test performances of all time and one of the best test series of all time. I mean, not least because this is a good Australian team as well. It's not like the Australian team of 2 years ago. This time they had Steve Smith, who is one of the best batsmen of all time. And he had he did score a century and he had a reasonable series, but he didn't have a dominant series in the way that we've come to expect, because India did keep him relatively quiet. And then they've also got Australia, probably the best bowling attack in the world at the moment. New Zealand might have something to say about that, but certainly right up there, including in Pat Cummins, someone who does appear to be well on his way to becoming an all-time great, and took 21 wickets in this series at 20. I mean, in fact, if you look at the series stats, India recorded one century in the series, which was Ajinkya Rahane, and one five-wicket haul, which was Mohammad Siraj on the penultimate day. And there are Aussies in the top two spots of both runs and wickets. So how do you explain it? How do you explain the fact they've won? I mean, I suppose that's partly because they had injuries. There were so many changes throughout the series. There weren't too many who played all four tests, and therefore that's why they're not at the top of the runs and wickets charts. But even in terms of averages, Rishabh Pant aside, they're not necessarily right up there. I mean, maybe it was just a kind of team effort rather than built on individuals. I remember that from the, going back a bit, but the 2009 Ashes, I think there were 8 centuries in the series, if memory serves. Only one of them was by an England player, and yet England won the series. And occasionally you are kind of shown that though stats are important, cricket is not all about stats.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think Australia obviously will be very disappointed to go from blowing India away, and the psychological impact of that, you know, to then go on and lose the series. You know, obviously they'll be pretty furious with themselves, I'm sure. And as you say, you know, it's a team with some absolute star quality, although a team that also does have some issues, certainly in the batting department. There's some real problems there, and maybe were, you know, possibly a little bit unfortunate in terms of injuries as well. You know, like Pekowski, someone who's sort of been hyped to a quite big level, came in, looked pretty good, and then obviously, you know, had to miss out in the final test. And then, you know, in the bowling department, you say Cummins was exceptional, Stark and Lyon maybe
less so,
not
at their best,
and maybe that bowling attack, you know, a bit tired by the end of it. And then obviously Cameron Green, who came in and didn't make a huge impact, even though he's well regarded. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, they still should have had enough to win.
Yeah, but it's for them, it is more about individual stars and those names we've mentioned, but maybe not that much beyond that at the moment. And one of their names, David Warner, is maybe struggling a bit, possibly on his way out. As you say, Stark and Lyon not at their best, and then in the batting they really do have a few issues around the openers and the kind of lower middle order. How do you think Tim Payne looks coming out of this? He didn't make it super easy for himself with some of his sledges and his, you know, see you at the Gabba comment has come back to bite him a bit. The Indians, particularly Ashwin, seem to be enjoying rubbing it in a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, it didn't bother me quite as much as some people. Like Jeff Lemon had a couple of articles where he sort of criticised Payne for the sledging and sort of calling it out of order, but then vehemently defended Smith for what he did. I know that, and both incidents, you know, Smith kind of, you know, doing a bit of shadow batting or whatever and wiping away. I don't know who
I can't remember who it was. Yeah.
But yeah, you know, wiping away the batsman's mark. Yeah, I mean, Payne, I'm sure, will be a bit, you know,
embarrassed.
Feel a bit
sheepish.
You'd be blushing slightly. Yeah, exactly. And you know, he's the captain of the side, so it'd be, you know, probably more annoyed about that. But I think probably worse things have been said on a cricket field. I don't know. I think people are very it depends how much we want to talk about this. Clearly, the Australians have made a bit of a rod for their own back with the, you know, the elite matesmanship and all of this jargon and this whole idea of them reshaping their culture and the test. The series, the TV series that kind of painted over the cracks. If you're fielding for whatever they fielded for, like 140 overs, I don't know. There's got to be some chat, otherwise they're not going to stand there in silence. And you know, look at us playing six-a-side football on a Sunday night in the lowest level football probably in Europe. You still, the some of the stuff that comes out of our mouths, you sort of regret. And I don't know, like, what? Yeah, okay, the stump mic. They know the stump mic is there, but after 90 or 110 overs or whatever, you know, and you're a little bit cheesed off and you're kind of out of the game, or you're feeling a bit, you know, I don't know, people would say stuff that, you know, doesn't necessarily come across that well. I don't think it was the most offensive thing I've ever heard.
No, it's still relatively tame, isn't it? As you say, in the context of amateur six size.
Yeah, exactly.
you can argue that he's supposed to be a role model in the way that we're not when we're playing six size football, but I agree with that. And I think to an extent it just kind of, it's obviously come back to bite him because they've lost the series I don't think he's necessarily doing anything different to Australian captains of the past. That's not to say that that's a justification for doing it, but the difference now is that he just doesn't quite have the ammunition that Australian captains of the past maybe had. I mean, I suppose he does in that he has Cummins and Hazelwood, and you could say, well, how... It's his fault, or like the questions have got to be asked of him that they've lost the series. given that India had all these inexperienced players and he had a world-class bowling attack at his disposal. But as we say, that, you know, some of them weren't quite on the top of their game, and you are going to look like an idiot if you lose. But it's not, I don't think 100% of the blame can be laid at his door for the fact that they have lost.
Yeah, I mean, I think in
terms of, he didn't have a good series personally, yeah, either with the bat or with the gloves.
But he loves jumping across first slip, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. In terms of the sledging, I don't know if unfortunate is the right word. It was just, you know, I think the fact that it came, whatever, the day after or a couple of days after, you know, those supporters had been chucked out of the ground for abusing some of the Indian fielders. Yeah, it's not a good look to be, for those two things to be alongside each other. And there's obviously no defence for the appalling and lame nonsense that some supporters obviously will decide to shout. I mean, so some people talking about how it's kind of like, you know, it's just sort of like fairly pathetic. The whole idea of even like interacting from the crowd and you know, the one-upsmanship of trying to sledge effectively. I don't know. I don't buy that. I think it's always happened. You're not telling me that people weren't sledging from the crowd in like 1880. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, no, I'm sure they were. I mean, but that's not necessarily a reason to continue doing it.
No, true.
It's just I don't think there's anything wrong with that, wrong with it at all. Like the idea of kind of banter or, you know, it's very strong banter from the crowd, but it's about sort of picking what that banter is.
Making it not like...
And, like, not being racist is a fairly obvious guideline.
Yeah, exactly. That's not particularly difficult. That's quite an easy thing to control. I mean, like, even like sledging around the bat, I don't know, like, I know people hate it, but I don't know, there's got to be a place for some sort of psychological tampering with the batsman, because otherwise what you do, you just sort of stand there and take it, you know.
But you're thinking it should be more along the lines of bowl him a piano, see if he can play that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, someone
swinging like a rusty gate out there, that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
high level,
I don't know, just trying to put, you know, as someone who's extremely susceptible to verbals, I don't know, a bit of undermining. Maybe I'm wrong.
No.
Maybe, just couldn't, maybe.
Couldn't be. Never happened before. Well, just to finish on India, you know, we've talked about some of their standouts in the series. Obviously, Rishabh Pant, Ajinkya Rahane had an amazing series. And, you know, it's not going to happen, but there could be a case for him continuing as captain, given how well he performed and India performed under him. Mohammad Siraj has been the real kind of find of the tour for them. You'd have to say it was an absolutely brutal spell on the fourth day. Those dismissals of Steve Smith and Manus Labuschagne, you know, yes, the ball kind of took off a crack, certainly for the Smith dismissal, but, you know, with that real pace and hostility, it was exciting to see. And I'd be surprised if he doesn't keep his place even when the kind of gun bowlers do come back. So, you know, perhaps we kind of underestimated, you know, in sort of talking before the series, suggesting that perhaps India would struggle because Kohli wouldn't be there. And then certainly when you saw, they lost the first test, but then when the injuries started piling up, you know, really everyone was writing them off. Perhaps we underestimated their depth, because it does seem like there is a lot of depth there. And that, to me, while clearly exciting in one sense, is a bit ominous, I think, certainly for the rest of the world, for the other test teams, but possibly for Test cricket, for the future of Test cricket, the future kind of competitiveness of Test cricket. This might be a big conclusion to draw just from a few matches, but if it is the case that there is all this depth now suddenly in India cricket, and, you know, I think AB de Villiers tweeted that it's kind of scary. It's scary how much depth there is, and that is true. But if it is the case now that India are sort of finally starting to realise their potential, or at least some of their potential, then, as I say, I think that's a bit ominous in a way, a bit troubling even, because, I mean, in a way it's surprising that they're not out of sight already in cricket, in international cricket, because on the face of it, there should be absolutely no contest between India and Australia, let alone India and New Zealand in cricket. You know, India and New Zealand, right? So New Zealand are still number one in the world, and we're going to talk about this. I mean, that's a ludicrous situation, really, because New Zealand is a country of 4 million people where cricket is not the most popular sport. And India is, what, 1.3 billion people where cricket is like a religion. They should be nowhere near.
Yeah. You could pick anyone in India and take them to New Zealand. Like, can they handle, like, you know, Wagner, you know?
Yeah.
When the ball's hooping, I don't know.
Sure, but it's such a big difference. But I mean, obviously the reason that it's not, that in the past that's not been enough of a factor, is because it's not just about population. It is about things like infrastructure and financing and all, you know. So there's good reasons for it. But obviously the infrastructure and the financing is there now in India. And so these players are now coming through. So if you ally that with the fact that they've got a population, whatever it is, 1,000 times the size almost, you know, at some point, whether it's in a couple of years or 10 years or 50 years, you know, it's not going to be competitive anymore. You know, maybe Pakistan and Bangladesh will still be close, but not the, by comparison, you know, very small nations like New Zealand and Australia. You would think, I mean, maybe I'm completely, again, yeah, it's mean, possible, maybe I'm completely wrong. Clearly, in rich countries, we have the infrastructure. Even like, so South Africa are competitive with a big population, but actually they mostly come from a couple of schools, don't they? Yeah. So, you know, there's many more reasons for it, but you just think with 1.3 billion people in a cricket mad country, surely you're going to find a lot of talented cricketers, a lot more than in a country of 4 million or 20 million like Australia.
Yeah, no, I think it's fair
just,
to say
it's just maths, isn't it?
You'd
it's
expect just India just to get better and better and have more and more kind of out and out freaks in their team. Yeah, you know, clearly some of these young players have come through, have been sort of groomed from a relatively early age and sort of built to play cricket, basically. But the flip side, yeah, I don't know, you make comparisons with other sports, you know, you take football, you know, Brazil, see, you know, a massive nation, you know, a populous place. Maybe isn't the comparison scales, you know, is slightly different to India versus New Zealand, to Brazil versus France or whatever. Mm. But, you know, I don't know. I think, I'm not sure that, you know, one side, even with that scale, you can only still pick 11 players, although your next 11 might be super strong as well. I don't know. There will always be competition.
Yeah, no, you're right. You can only pick 11 in the end, but it just seems like if you're just sort of trying to identify talent in a population, and if you've got, 1.34 billion people, and the Indian and New Zealand population kind of mixed together, and you just say, right, find the 11 best cricketers in there, it's much more likely that they're going to come from the 1.3 billion Indian population than the 4 million New Zealand population. That's just probability.
Well, your number one pick's Kane Williamson anyway.
Well, so, yeah. But as I say, there is a lot more to it than that, because it's about all sorts of things like infrastructure. But that infrastructure is increasingly in place in India. So,
and particularly with the IPL, the kind of, you know, they're becoming kind of full blown academy, you know, the whole
more
thing
more
is
kind of professionalization. Yeah. You know, it's just going to happen at some point. And it just I've thought that for a long time and it hasn't quite, but it just feels like we're moving much closer to that now, just seeing that level of depth that perhaps wasn't there before.
I mean, when you consider the IPL is a decade old, how old is it?
It's 13 years old. 13. Now, isn't it?
Yeah, when you consider the IPL is, you know, obviously more than a decade old, it's astonishing India haven't won more limited overs tournaments as well. I mean, they arguably have underperformed massively on the international stage. But then, as you say, the direction of travel is certainly ominous for everyone else when you look at, you know, a series like this. But, you know, play this series again or, you know, rewind, you know, I don't know, what would have been the win viz for India after the 36 all out? Or even at the start of the series, it would have been pretty slim. I mean, maybe one day when India can, like, wholly dominant, they just won't play international cricket and they'll be like a US, they'll just play amongst themselves.
Well, that's it, yeah.
And then everyone else will have, you know, international tournaments.
It might just end up being a totally different landscape.
Yeah. So we might have to worry about it.
Well, yeah, but then that's not necessarily what I want.
No,
that's why I think it's a bit ominous. But anyway, might not happen. I might be totally wrong about that. So just to round up then.
Good test.
Do we think then that this was... We've said it's one of the best series of all time. Is this the best series you've seen since 2005, do you think? I'm going to assume that you agree with me that it's still not quite as good as 2005 on the basis that 2005 was the summer of love.
Yeah.
And we were 18 and nothing will ever match that. But I also still would say it's not quite as good a series as that, but let's not have that conversation. But is assuming that it's always going to be since 2005.
Yeah.
Is this the best series you've seen since then?
Yeah, I think it's hard to argue with that. Yeah.
I think I would agree.
I mean, you know, there are other, you know, the fact that, well, I mean, it was great that there was a crowd there at all. And in many ways it did feel like, it kind of felt like a day five crowd.
There was noise.
There was response to what was going on the pitch. Yeah, it was nice that it wasn't, this series didn't happen in a vacuum, in a bubble where there was just a fake crowd noise to be played. Because I'm not, that did certainly add to it as a spectator. And I'm sure for the players as well, it gave it a bit of extra, the fact that they could, do a lap of honour at the end, that really added to it. But the flip side, I guess, is that 2005 was so great. Part of what it was so great about it was the fact that the English public kind of bought into it to such a ludicrous extent, and the crowds and the queues and the everything, it was kind of one off really in many ways.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I was going to say that I thought, and I said on the pod before the start of the series, that I thought that the pandemic would make it feel less significant.
You wrote it off.
Yeah, or not that it would be less exciting or less enjoyable to watch, but just it wouldn't feel like it just wouldn't matter as much, because it just feels, sport feels to me more like something that is just like, it's just
a
distraction to cheer us up rather than something that actually matters. And I still feel that about most sport, but when something really kind of catches fire like this, I wonder if anything it makes it feel more significant. Because it is a kind of ray of light for a lot of people in an incredibly dark and difficult moment. For a lot of people, I think, this really did matter in a way that it perhaps, or even more than it perhaps would in normal times.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I think it's a good point.
Thanks.
I mean, it was one of those things where, obviously I was sort of scrolling through Twitter, throughout the morning, but as people were getting up, and I was by no means obviously the earliest, but, there was a real sense of by about 7 o'clock UK time, pretty much anyone who was a vaguely cricket fan was like, get to a TV, something big's happening here. And that doesn't happen very often in any sport, but obviously with cricket, there is Test cricket gives you that opportunity to be aware of something, but then, to be sort of pulled into it at different times or whatever. But yeah, the fact that it sucked everyone in to that extent, as you say, it kind of suggests that it had an effect beyond even what it was, and it was an extraordinary thing.
It was a kind of unifying force in a way for cricket people. So it was a good series, is what I'm saying.
It was all right.
Yeah. The only thing wrong with it, my one criticism would be the time zone. Why can Australia not get their act together and get themselves a decent, good, upstanding, normal time zone?
Yeah.
It's a nightmare. I saw very little of this series live, I have to say, especially with a one-year-old. I'm just not going to make it to the midnight start. And then, I mean, I saw some early mornings, but again, this is a purely, obviously, personal, subjective thing, but It as much as I do think this is the best series since 2005, I'm almost slightly resentful of it, because I just wish it was...
You're not a student now.
It was 10 years ago and I could have watched it all.
No, it's a fair point. And to be fair, the Sri Lanka series as well is much better, because they take lunch at 7 a.m.
I mean, that is just the most annoying thing in the world. It's that every day
of
the Sri Lanka test, I would get everything sorted out, have my shower, get some breakfast, sit down the sofa, right, turn on the cricket, and they're like, and that's lunch. This is absolutely infuriating.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, well, that, as we say, wasn't, of course, the only test cricket taking place this week. England are in Sri Lanka for a quick two-test series ahead of their marquee tour of India in February. I'm really looking forward to that India series, but it is a bit silly, really, isn't it? India playing, like, eight tests on the bounce against Australia and England, then there's another four tests against England in the summer. I mean, talk about the big three kind of milking it. Well, there's Ashes later this year as well. They've kind of stopped pretending now. But anyway, yes, let's talk about this Sri Lanka series. It's been a long time coming, of course, because they were due to play these tests, England, last March, but had to come home when the pandemic kicked off. So rearranged tour here. Both tests are in Goole. The first test was won by England. A pretty extraordinary opening day saw Sri Lanka skittled out for just 135, with Dom Best taking 5 for 30. Some pretty brainless batting at times, you'd have to say. England was 17 for 2, but then strong partnerships between Joe Root and Johnny Bairstow, and Joe Root and Dan Lawrence on debut saw them comfortably pass Sri Lanka's total. And Joe Root ended up making a double 100, 228 was the bulk of England's 421. So big first innings leads. Sri Lanka fought back, showed much more backbone in their second innings. They actually put on a partnership of over 100 for the first wicket. And Lahiri Tiramani, back in the side, made a century. His first test century since 2013. A gap of 8 years between centuries there. And Angelo Matthews, 71 as well, meant that they made 359, and they made England stay out in the field for 137 overs. But Jack Leach, with 5 for 122, led England through Sri Lanka's batting. That meant they had a target of just 74. Now, they were really wobbling at the end of the fourth day when they lost three wickets with just 14 on the board. Joe Root run out. But Johnny Bairstow and Dan Lawrence stayed together till the end of the day and came back on day five. And they both finished unbeaten to steer England to that small target. So England won the game by 7 wickets. Now, did you see much of this, Tony? Did you see much of this test? You mainly saw the lunch interval.
Yeah, I saw a lot of lunch. yeah, I saw a bit of it, yeah.
Was it a good win for England?
I mean, yeah, tough to complain too much.
But?
No, I don't know. No, I think it was all right. I mean, there was a fair amount to enjoy about it. As you say, like, you know, Sri Lanka's first innings was about as pathetic as you kind of get in terms of a way to open a series, but I'm you know, quite pleased to see them fight back and at least make England work for it in the end. Yeah, I think a pretty competent win for England all round. I mean, that, in contrast to the test at the Gabba, like it just does feel very flat at Goole when there's no crowd. And yeah, I mean, I'd love to go to Goole. I'd love to go to Sri Lanka and see some cricket.
It looks amazing.
Yeah. I mean, even at the sort of best of times in Sri Lanka, you know, England going down there to play a test match, it can feel quite flat on the TV. I'm sure it doesn't, you know, there. But obviously without any supporters at all, it was, it does feel a little lifeless.
Yeah. And then, you know, you turn it on and it's like Joe Root kind of bowling a few off spinners and Lahiri Tiramani just padding it away is not necessarily quite the same level.
Exactly. It's on the other end of the spectrum.
It's not quite the advert for test cricket. But I mean, I think it was a decent game. And it is a terrific win for England. Like any win on the subcontinent, you know, you'd have bitten the hand off. I don't know which hand, you'd have bitten someone's hand off for that at one point in time. But the strange thing is that I'm not convinced that they actually played that well. I mean, it, as you said, competent is probably a good word. Like they did a competent job, but I just don't think they played as well as it perhaps seems, because you look at that scorecard and, yeah, skittling for Sri Lanka for 135 on the first day, like it looks really impressive, but really for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's hard to overstate just how appallingly Sri Lanka batted. Like it was just a lot of terrible shots, and
Don Bess's fifer was as ropey a five wicket haul as you'll see.
Yeah, so it's not necessary to. There's no criticism of England, but they were just pretty lucky, I think, that they turned up and Sri Lanka were quite that bad. And then it was really founded on that one amazing innings from Joe Root, but Dan Lawrence, the only other England batsman to pass 50 in the match. And as you say, that it was a bit of a ropey bowling performance from Bess. Both Bess and Leach have ended up with a bag of wickets in this game without bowling all that impressively. I mean, they were fine in the second innings, but they've both bowled much better than that for much less reward, I think. So, I'm very pleased for Jack Leach. I mean, he's obviously been through the mill in terms of his health, and I think hadn't played a game of first class cricket since 2019 before this. So it's understandable that he's maybe a bit rusty, but I hope he gets a decent run in the side now, because he deserves it.
And obviously there's a big assignment ahead, isn't there, in India. I mean, yeah, I agree with you completely. Like, I'm very pleased England won, and as I say, there were things to enjoy. So good to see Joe Root in the big runs again. Hopefully that sets him up for a good trot now. And if he has a good series in India, then you could probably, not that it's the be all and end all, but you sort of start to then perceive him maybe as being where he should be, kind of back amongst the very top players
with
the game.
Big boys.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Dining at the top table.
There's obviously been some discussion of Root off the back of this, and whether he's underrated, or whether he's the fact that he's, while he doesn't convert all the time,
whether he's underrated, rated, or overrated.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know, he's all three simultaneously.
Underwhelming, whelming, or overwhelming.
Some people were saying, well, he obviously contributes a lot of runs to the team, and his figures are, for where he is in the stage of his career, is very, very impressive, and he'll surely go down as one of England's greats.
Well, he will.
Well, he will, exactly. But, the very nature of cricket is you do want to see batsmen go on and make match-winning scores, not just chipping in all the time, as useful as that may be. And that's just the nature of the beast, isn't it? And, as you say, so Dan Lawrence looks really good. Exciting player on debut. Like Stuart Broad bowled very well.
Bowling as well as he ever has, I think, Broad.
Yeah.
Which is quite saying something, really.
So it's some great stuff, but obviously
Butler good behind the stumps as well.
Yeah. Like Sibley and Crawley, obviously didn't really make much of an impact. Bairstow at three, we're going to talk about.
Well, let's talk about it. I mean, yeah, Sibley's a bit of a worry, because I think he looks a bit dodgy against the spinners technically. And with a tour of India coming up, I don't know if that's quite what you want. Rory
Keaton Jennings on the speed dial.
Well, Jennings is actually a very good player of spin and has done well in the subcontinent, so it might not be the worst call. Rory Burns will probably come back in India, and you'd imagine it would be Sibley who would make way. But genuinely, I'm not sure that Jennings would be the worst call, but that's perhaps another conversation. But yeah, Bairstow at three. How do you feel about that, Tony? Are you happy about that?
It doesn't feel right, does it?
What are your emotions at the moment?
I don't know. I mean, I bet you look at, he obviously had a decent, 47 in the first innings. And then, whilst some were losing their heads in that sort of wobbly kind of moment, as England chased a very modest total, he was still there at the end, 35 not out. So he hasn't done an awful lot wrong.
No, it was a good game.
In this match, so,
it was definitely a good game for him. But he is a very lucky boy, I think, to be in this team. Because before this test, he was averaging 18 in his previous 10 tests. He really just doesn't have a very good record in test cricket over the last few years. And he was dropped because of that and hasn't really done much to warrant a recall.
Yeah.
So it is just the case that he's, someone that the management like, and it's almost like, who should we pick? Let's pick Johnny Bairstow, because he's just been around for a long time. And it's also the fact that he is still
Johnny Bairstow.
He's still Johnny Bairstow, and he's still producing in white ball cricket. So it sort of, it just feels natural, I think, for the England selectors to just keep picking Bairstow. But he's actually not really done much to warrant that in red ball cricket. But all that said, an informed Bairstow is clearly one of the best batsmen in England. I'm not sure that he's a test number three, but he's made a good start here. I don't quite know, though, because obviously Ben Stokes will come back. So there, someone's going to have to make way. And, presumably that's going to be Dan Lawrence. But he was so impressive here that, for me, I'd like to see Lawrence get a real run in the team. I don't know if he's a number three either, but that's a call they'll have to make at some point.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, obviously if Lawrence has a good second test, if he tons up in the second test, then, there's that does make things difficult.
Yeah, although Ben Folkes turned up in Sri Lanka a couple of years ago.
And,
it wasn't enough. Bairstow came back anyway. So it's always Bairstow, isn't it? It was a fine performance by England. I don't mean to criticise them, but it's just, I think they were a bit fortunate in some senses. A mutual friend of ours, Tony, takes a kind of passing interest in cricket, said to me that I saw that England won in Sri Lanka, and they were saying on the radio that that it's a really great win because Sri Lanka is maybe the hardest place in the world to win. Is that right? And I was like, no. I don't know who it was that said that on the radio. Michael Vaughan crossed my mind. I don't know what you think, Tane, but it's arguably one of the easiest.
Well,
not to say that it's easy, but if England are going to win a test match anywhere outside of England at the moment, is there anywhere more likely than Sri Lanka just now?
Well, no, probably not, really.
Maybe South Africa is the only one, I think. England have a very good record in South Africa, and the conditions kind of suit them. But other than that, the conditions suit them in New Zealand, but New Zealand are very, very good.
Yeah.
Definitely not Australia or not India or the UAE. They've struggled
Bangladesh,
in the Caribbean.
I'd be worried.
Yeah. As I say, it's not to say that winning in Sri Lanka is easy. Obviously, the heat, the pitches, but that applies almost anywhere. And, last time they won 3-0, and they've actually now won 5 tests in a row in Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
So,
clearly this is a Sri Lanka team that are, in a bit of a dry spell, just in terms of, I think people would have been pretty worried seeing what they produced in the first innings. And as I say, good to see them make a bit of a fist of it. And as you say, Tirumana... very long spell without troubling the scorers too much. so they recovered well, and I think it does set up the second test maybe a bit better than it looked like being. They're clearly a team kind of fumbling around for some sort of way forward.
I'm just not sure they're up to much at the moment. And in terms of going back to what you said before about the kind of health and competitiveness of Test cricket, I think they are a real worry. Test cricket does need as many teams as possible to be good, and there's problems in various places. And I think Sri Lanka are one of the big one of the big red flags at the moment. They've still got a lot of talent. They've got a lot of talent in the batting. Kusal Mendes is one of the most talented batsmen in the world, but is just not delivering. Obviously went on a Tony Kerr-esque run of 4 ducks in a row, with the fourth one being in the first innings of this game. But there's a lot of talent, but they're just very inconsistent with the bat, and the bowling just really isn't there. And Bull Denier looks like a decent bowler, and Dilrawan Pereira bowled well against England a couple of years ago, but it's just not on the same level as other teams around the world at the moment. It's just not.
Yeah, exactly. And every team has their greats and comparisons and stuff, but you just look at the bowling lineup they've got at the moment. They just don't have the weapons that they have had over the last couple of decades.
It's just not got the names to anything. I had a look at the Sri Lanka lineup from that Colombo test in 2012 when Peterson scored that incredible 100. Angelo Matthews played in both that game and this game in Gaul. Actually, Tiramana played in that game too. But, if you take those two out, I'm not sure that any of this current team would get in that 2012 team. The batting lineup was Tirumana and then Dilshan, Sangakkara, Jayawardena, Samarawira, and then Ranganathan Hirath, in the bowling. So, and now, you know, there's a danger of that becoming a sort of West Indies thing where you're constantly comparing to a kind of golden generation that is just never going to be reproduced. And it could be that it's just a kind of natural flux and there'll be another generation come through shortly. And it's just a kind of in between moment. But it is a bit of a concern, I think, that, and even Tiramana scoring 100, I mean, it was a very good knock and you can't not be pleased for him, but it's a bit of a damning indictment, I think, of Sri Lankan cricket that he's still in the team or that they've gone back to him when he hasn't scored 100 for 8 years. So I'm not actually saying that they won't win this second test. I think there's a good chance that England are not like a world-beating test team at the moment. It's still tough conditions for them, home conditions for Sri Lanka. You can well imagine England getting spun out at least once for nothing. So Sri Lanka may well win the test, but I think England were always strong favourites for this series, and I was slightly surprised that there was a feeling that that wasn't the case.
This pundit on the radio talking nonsense.
Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah, it'd be interesting. Obviously we'll follow it closely, but the prospects for England in India, I don't know. It'd be nice if England, as an England supporter, it'd be nice if England, yeah, make a good fist of the second match as well, the second test, and go into it with a little bit of confidence. You know, I think if they were to lose the second test now, it would put things on a bit of a bit of shaky ground going to India.
Yeah, well, that's going to be a very tough challenge, isn't it? But we'll talk about that, Tony. We're waffling on a bit here.
Yeah, we are a bit.
There's just so much to discuss. And one thing that we haven't discussed, which we really should, is New Zealand. And in other circumstances, New Zealand might well have led the pod, Tony. It's, would have been the kind of big story.
Well, it would have been about if we'd done the pod a couple of weeks ago.
This is true, yeah. If we'd got our act together. Because after wiping West Indies and Pakistan at home, New Zealand have become the number one test team in the world for the first time in their history. They are the seventh test team to become number one. Do you know who are the only... I was going to say the only one. You obviously know that Bangladesh and Zimbabwe and Ireland and Afghanistan haven't. Do you know which is the only one of the top eight, the big eight, that hasn't now?
Since the ranking... When did the rankings actually come in?
90s.
West Indies?
Nope.
Pakistan?
Nope. Pakistan were number one not long ago.
Well, so has everyone else been.
West Indies were number one in 95. There's one you're missing.
I don't think I am.
We've just talked about him.
Sri Lanka.
Correct.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah. I wasn't really listening to what you said.
First time.
I thought you'd said Sri Lanka. You'd ignored Sri Lanka or something. No. Sri Lanka.
No.
Oh, no, I said Sri Lanka first. Yeah, that's obvious.
New Zealand, for the first time in their history, they are number one. Yeah, this is a terrific story, Tane, isn't it? Just a kind of the feel-good story of the year. And hard to argue, I think, that they don't deserve it or that it's a false position.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. You know, obviously led by the number one batsman in the world at the moment. Across sort of multi-format, the best, probably the most reliable and consistent and viable batsman. Yeah.
And attractive.
Yeah, exactly.
Sexy.
It's getting late.
Lovely Caney, you're talking
but
about.
Yeah, they're just like things are all just all seem to be falling into place for them, don't they? You know, they've got players clearly playing, or you would think are playing above their level. Certainly, if you
above their pay grade,
compared, their test performances to first class averages, and yeah, they're whatever's happening there, they're getting slightly more out of that team than they ought to.
Yeah,
and then obviously they've got Carl Jameson's come in and. Or is doing a Philander and then some. Just a very likable team. I mean,
even better than Philander, actually.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I said during the second test, just got to get down to New Zealand to watch some cricket.
Yeah.
Really got to.
It's definitely on the list, isn't it? It's on the bucket list. No, you're right. They are kind of wringing every last drop of ability out of that, like a sort of dish towel. They're wringing tight to squeeze every... drop out of it and just maximizing, aren't they? Maximizing their talent. And as I say, they're really difficult to say that they aren't the number one test team in the world. They haven't lost a test match at home for 4 years now. That's 17 in a row. unbeaten at home. They've won 13 of those, beating everybody, basically. Away from home, not to the same extent, but still some impressive results away from home. I'm not sure I'd fancy them to win in India at the moment, but then I'm not sure I'd fancy India to win in New Zealand. So in terms of who's the best team in the world, I think, you know, it's close amongst the top three, or certainly the top two. But I think New Zealand are the best test team in the world right now. And as you say, they're getting the most out of everybody, and they actually seem to be getting better. Kane Williamson is getting better, which is scary for everyone else. And then, as you mentioned, they've added Kyle Jameson to an already stellar pace attack of Bolt, Southey, Wagner, who's actually the best at this point, statistically the best. But yeah, Jameson with 4 5-fers in his first 6 tests and a bowling average of 13 is, I think, has now got the best average of any test bowler to take more than 20 wickets since the 19th century, I believe.
Yeah, nuts. And what, he's averaging about 50-odd with the bat as well, isn't he?
So just very exciting. I mean, the question on everyone's lips, Dane, it's all anyone's talking about, is can they make it to the World Test Championship final? They're now in the top two.
Well, it suddenly looks quite... This World Test Championship suddenly come alight, hasn't it?
Well, I've said from the get-go, it's a great idea, brilliantly executed, and I'm really into it and really excited about it.
So on the old PCT...
What does that mean?
I don't know. What does it actually stand for?
I don't know.
Percentage points.
Percentage cricket total, I think.
But it basically means like what percentage of points have they taken. Anyway, on the old PCT, India 71.7% PCT.
Does it not just stand for percentage?
No, does it? That would make sense.
I'd assume so, yeah.
Why wouldn't they just use the percentage symbol?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
The ICC. Mm. No, I love the ICC. India 71.
Pending possible job offers.
Yeah.
I love the ICC.
I don't know. Yeah. India 71.7. New Zealand 70 on the nose. Australia 69.2. England 65.2.
So I think the permutations are New Zealand now aren't playing any more tests before the final. So they're going to finish on 70. India are almost certainly qualified. I think they'd have to lose, basically have to get whitewashed by England to not get there, which is not going to happen. England could get there, but I think they've got to win at least 3-0 or so they've got to win by 3, so they've got to win 3 or 4-0 to qualify. So it's essentially between Australia and New Zealand. At the moment, it's New Zealand. Australia might not play another test because they're supposed to be touring South Africa, but it may not necessarily go ahead depending on the COVID situation. If it does, they've got to win comprehensively to reclaim that spot. Certainly if they lose or draw, but even if they win by one test, I don't think that's enough. So,
which, to be fair, it's not out of the question.
No, no, it's not. But it is now kind of odds on that it's going to be India and New Zealand in that Test Championship final at Lord's in June. Is it June or July? June, I think. I mean, who would you fancy in that contest if that is what it ends up being, an India New Zealand final? Where would your money be?
I don't know. It'd be pretty fun, I think.
Suddenly, I'm actually
suddenly buzzing,
moderately excited about that.
Buzzing your nut for this.
I think they are the best two teams in the world, and I would like to see the prospect of them facing off in neutral conditions is actually quite exciting.
Yeah, I agree.
It doesn't justify the whole thing, but you know, but if they were to just arrange a one-off game between India and New Zealand at Lord's, I would like to see it.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, you've obviously got two great, truly great batsmen, some great cast of supporting characters, two good bowling attacks in those conditions. Bring it on.
All right, well, I think that's going to be about it for the podcast this time. Have you enjoyed this one, Tone?
Yeah, it's been good, hasn't it?
Do you think we made it work in this room?
I mean, it's hard to imagine. Yeah, we did all right. When I think back to, you know, a few years ago when I used to work at the local radio station, we would record in a proper studio.
Yeah.
We've really regressed since then. But now, yeah, it's kind of like, yeah, it's all falling apart.
Yeah.
Sort of pinning mics to the back of wicker chairs.
Most podcasts, you know, you kind of, as time goes on, you kind of develop some success and you move up in the world and your recording setup gets better and better. Ours is getting worse and worse.
Yeah, we're like the sort of faded... Yeah,
12 years in, it's worse than it's ever been. Yeah. It's pokier than it's ever been. But maybe we can do it in here again. Next time you could be on the cross trainer. So
yeah, why not?
You could pod while getting fit.
Quite keen for that. But actually, yeah, I mean, you know, talking about cricket, it's quite amazing that in the midst of the worst of the, probably the worst of the pandemic, like a couple of weeks of genuinely quite brilliant cricket all round. Obviously, as we discussed in Australia, you know, but the great story of New Zealand summiting the test rankings and yeah, and then the victory thrown in there as well. So yeah, quite amazing.
It's definitely helping to cheer us up a little bit. But yes, anyway, we are going to be back on the reg during the England India series. There's going to be lots to talk about there, I'm sure, Tane. But between now and then, if you enjoy the podcast, do get more involved on social media. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Cricket Show. We're on Instagram at World Cricket Show. We're still on Twitter, aren't we?
And Ashes Daily as well. Don't forget Ashes Daily.
We've not been booted off yet.
I wonder if we've got any extra followers on Ashes Daily.
Good question. We talked about it last time.
12 followers. Couldn't tell you if any of them are new, though.
I'm going to say no. Is anyone listening to this? I searched for Ashes Daily. So it's not taking me to the account. It's taking me to all the tweets that have mentions of Ashes Daily.
Right.
Gordon McRae on the 30th of December 2010. Chilling in the new At Cricket Show studio with Ashes Daily. World Cricket Show tweeting on the 15th of February 2011 at Ashes Daily. Lums on Twitter.
2010-11. Bloody hell.
I mean, that's a long time ago now.
That does feel a while ago.
Anyway, yeah, so we're on Twitter at Cricket Show and at Ashes Daily. If you want to get in touch with us, you know, if you want to send us like a missive, a longer missive, then do send us an email, worldcricketshow@gmail.com. And if you enjoy the show, then why not leave a rating and or a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to it, because that does help to bring new people to the show. So thank you to everyone who has been doing that. But that's it from the two of us. I think stay in school, everyone. Enjoy the cricket, and we'll see you soon.
Yeah.
I've shut my laptop. We're done. Bye-bye for now.
Cheers. I can smell your fear. Ba da da ba ba, ba da da ba ba. Ba da da ba ba, ba da da ba ba. Ba da da ba ba, ba da da ba ba. Ba da da ba ba, ba da da ba ba.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.